I'll reconvene the hearing. And first up seems to be Steve.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. Hello, Commissioner. Some late petition. Just by way of introduction, I've got with me here today Mr. Anderson, who's the CEO of NZ Ski.
Could you just pull the microphone over much closer to yourself, please?
Okay, that's better. And Mr. Dent and Mr. Skelton. NZ Ski filed a submission on the proposed plan, requesting that the ski area subzone be extended to take in greater areas within both Coronet Peak and Remarkable ski areas, and a new subzone B was also sought on land that's owned on the lower slopes of the Remarkable near the entrance to the ski field. NZ Ski is not presenting evidence and advice the decision of the council regarding its submission on the extended zone over the Coronet Peak ski field area, and I think Mr. Dent has explained that.
They're not withdrawing the submission.
That's not my understanding, they're not presenting
evidence.
The submissions and evidence for this hearing are limited to NZ Ski submission seeking an expansion of two areas associated with the ski area. And just on that point, it did come to our attention yesterday when we listened to the recordings from the session that you appeared to have said initially with the council's GIS map. That was something that can be conveyed to us in the lead up to the hearing. So,
it was in the summary and legal submissions that were lodged by the council on Friday. I think it was last week.
Yes, well,
I've asked for further clarification, but it appears that that area above Kirby Basin is actually in the Central Otago district.
Yes. Well, we'd be interested in that clarification because I know the company did spend some time with Clark Fortune McDonald relied on survey accurate data in terms of the area that the extension is over. So I was particularly interested in having that issue clarified. And I accept that, obviously, but if it's within the Central Otago district area, then it's outside this council's jurisdiction to deal with it, obviously, but in the event it's not, obviously there's evidence before you about the appropriateness of the extension of that zone of that land.
That's something that we need to be absolutely sure about.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you'd be able to spend time with Ms. Banks and agree on a map that presents to us the topo information and the boundaries of both the ski area subzone and the district subzone. If you've got survey data from Clark Fortune McDonald, that might assist.
Yes, we're certainly willing to be involved in that process and a collaborative effort around clarifying exactly where that boundary is.
Mm. Because I think it also affects the area above Lake Alta. That part of that is within this district, but where the boundary runs through there is also unclear.
Yes.
From our point of view.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
That would be helpful if we could get some agreement on that.
Yes. Thank you very much. At paragraph 4, I just talk about the extension over the ridge line that was just discussed and above Lake Alta, and the second area that we're seeking the extension over is located below Mr. Skelton's interpretation of the ONL boundary. By way of background, the extension and addition has been sought for a number of reasons. to encapsulate all land areas where NZ ski patrons ski or board and in which a snow patrol screening and avalanche control are undertaken, to provide future ski area development in the Doolans, and to provide for the provision of ancillary buildings and activities necessary to maintain the efficient and effective operation of the remarkable ski area. The Scrub Zone Z is within the submitted ownership, located immediately adjacent to the ski area access road and contains approved by way of resource consent after storage, car park and signage and commercial transport activity. From the submitted perspective, the site is a logical location for rezoning to enable future activities of the type already established. The ski area in the rest of the zone is different to a number of other areas in the district, and that the base facilities and car parks are located within a pinch point in the valley. As such, NZ Ski is evidence that there is not a geographically large area available to provide for car parking, storage and industry resource development. And this suggests that there's a recent example of a building that's just been consented over the last period where NZ Ski has been pushed to the limit in terms of where it's been able to site that building. One of the key reasons NZ Ski is seeking the sub-zone is to provide the potential to provide residential or visitor accommodation for its seasonal staff. The ski area employs approximately 450 staff in the peak of the season. This again explains the large and growing risk to the company's business from the shortage of suitable affordable accommodation in Queenstown for its workers. Just moving on to the issues, definition of ski area activities. I've set out the definition there from the notes I've had, I won't read it. The council appears to accept that a possible interpretation of the definition is that which is advanced and discussed in the student's evidence. That is, that ski area activity as defined could result in the requirement for non-confined consent where those activities are undertaken outside of the sub-zone and that this is unintended. While the council promotes a minor rule change to clarify that some activities as defined taking place outside the zone are permitted, Mr. Dent's evidence that this is ad hoc to identify and define the area activity, have a zone purpose that anticipates such activities to be undertaken within the sub-zone, and then to provide additional rules that prevent such defined activities being undertaken elsewhere. And just on that point, the rule change does provide for some activities to be undertaken outside the boundary of permitted activity, but our reading of that rule change is that it doesn't address commercial skiing. In the area above Lake Alta, which is still within the Queenstown Lakes District boundary, it is quite feasible that there will be commercial guiding or ski lessons, and those don't appear to be covered within the ambit of the rule that the council is proposing. So NZ Ski submits in line with Mr. Dent's evidence that it's more effective an outcome for the boundary to be appropriately identified to encapsulate where those ski area activities are happening. And to address the council's concerns regarding the extension of that area in the vicinity of Lake Alta, specifically building earthworks, a building restriction area, and the company's rules have been proposed to Mr. Dent's evidence. Scope, the O&L line, and the extent of the sub-zone Z, NZ Ski clarified that it doesn't seek to change the location of the O&L line as it's bisected to the site. Sought to be zoned by zone B, rather Mr. Skelton has undertaken the exercise of determining where development is appropriate in the context of where that line and opinion should lie across the site, and this has then informed the revised extent of the boundary for that sub-zone. The council in its evidence has helpfully explained how the O&L classification and assessment criteria apply in the sub-zone and to activities within them. All of the ski area sub-zones within the district are within the O&L, sub-zone B will thus be no exception. This again addresses the planning and assessment implications of this further, with reference to the definition of ski area activities in the introductory statement. So so far as the council's landscape evidence is concerned, I hold the same concern as Mr. Dent, that Dr. Reid's landscape assessment is very brief, both because prime evidence and rebuttal. She appears to misunderstand the status of the activities that are proposed, specifically earthworks and buildings, as well as the activities, ski area activities and activities at the time. Thus unclear to what extent her opinion may have been affected, had she a better understanding and appreciation of the provisions proposed. Given those failings, then she has had to put the evidence of Mr. Skelton into that service. The next section, just relevant to the existing environment, I don't think I need to take you through that because I know that it's been covered in some submissions on behalf of Treaty Code, etc. I think there was a concern when the bank's rebuttal evidence was circulated that there was going to be an argument that the existing environment wasn't relevant to plan changes. I know that it's not the council's position. That section, that section I just addressed the shot over park decision and also the King Family Trust decision. So I think we're all on the same page there. From paragraph 42 to 44 of his evidence, Mr. Dent describes some of the existing consent activities on the site they include buildings, car parking, storage, signage and commercial activities. The subzone provides all these activities together with accommodation, all to be ancillary to the operation of the remarkable ski area. The purpose of listing the activities was not to use them as a springboard to justify further like development or confine the environment to what exists on the site by way of consented activities, but rather it was to provide a comprehensive overview of the site and the existing use or activity, and to provide a high degree of veracity to NZSK's submission that this subzone is an essential adjunct to its ski area activity. Furthermore, the activities are illustrative of the manner in which development can be appropriately accommodated in this landscape. What's the most appropriate RMA outcome? Referred there at paragraph 23 to the relevant sections of the Act. Most appropriate acknowledges there can be more than one appropriate way to achieve the purpose of the Act. The task of the territorial authority is to select the most appropriate way, the one it considers best. The submitted case is that rezoning of the lower site, subzone B, with limitations on built form and restrictions for activities ancillary to the operation of the ski area, is the most appropriate RMA outcome. It is a more effective and efficient use of the land than if it were to be left in a rural zone and subject to the notified provisions of the CPP. NZSK submits that its rezoning submission is consistent with the anticipated purpose of the zone. For the council, Ms. Banks supports the principle that activities that support the operation of the ski field should be located in proximity to it. And Mr. Dent discusses the efficiency of locating activities directly associated with ski area operations on the site and the benefits of this option, rather than at Jack's Point or Henry Downs, which are geographically displaced from the ski area and don't have the added benefit of control in terms of affordability, which comes with NZSK's ownership of the site. While the council's goal of streamlining and reducing the complexity of the plan is laudable, its submission that this rezoning will not run counter to this, the amendments proposed are easily understood and they are concise. Just other issues, earthworks. The evidence to NZSK is that in determining whether it's appropriate to allow the subzone and the extension above Lake Alter, rules regulating earthworks must be addressed. NZSK does not seek to replicate provisions that might come in a later plan change. For present purposes, it's a matter of timing. The rule must sit somewhere, and it can't wait for a future plan change process. That's not to say, however, that rules relating to earthworks cannot in the future be relocated to another part of the plan. Traffic and servicing, vehicle access to the remarkable ski area is constructed for commercial access standards, presently providing some 5,000 visitors per day to the ski area, both in private vehicles and large coaches. Mr. Dean stresses this further in his introductory statement, in short, however, this is not a racial consent application. The level of detail and assessment so far as potential traffic effects are concerned need not match that which might be expected in a racial consenting process. Particularly, this is the case here, where ANZCA has not permitted on the rezoning of the level of control at the resource consenting stage allows full consideration of such issues as one's management discretion. Now, so far as servicing is concerned, council does not appear to be opposed to on-site private systems for water and wastewater. Then the opinion that the site could be appropriately serviced by means other than council committee-related services, and further that the proposed provision for the council discretion on such matters is part of the resource consenting process. Visibility from the ski field access road, Mr. Skelton addresses this matter in his summary statement as evidence as to the effect that the part of the site proposed for the subzone overlay holds relatively limited visual community as it zigzags across the low eastern foot of the mountain. So those are my next submissions. Happy to answer any questions you might have of me.
I'm interested in your views on where does skiing cease to be commercial and fall within the general term of recreation? Does it the holding of a lift pass automatically make it commercial skiing, or is the holding of a lift pass only commercial when you're using the lift?
I would say the former, because in the case of the remarkable, we're not always having to use the lift to access various terrain that's skiable. And the example of that is what we've been promoting with the area above Lake Ultra, because the Kirby Basin chairlift has opened up more skiable terrain, and we're seeing that area being skied. So it was, you said you used to have to lift to there, but then you're skiing around.
Do you need to pay someone money to walk up your skis to that area and ski?
I don't believe so. I believe that road toll, so if you're not using any of the skis.
Well, that's what raises the question for me, because it's, is it the skiing that's commercial or the lifting that's commercial? And because in all the ski areas I've seen, people who are much better skiers than I ever have been or will be go skiing outside of the subzone. And they may or may not use the lift to start that, but I don't see that automatically becomes commercial skiing, does it?
No, it's a combination of things, I think. I mean, you know, primarily people are up there because of the infrastructure that's been provided and they pay for their lift tickets, etc. And I think that there may well be private backcountry skiers or what have you that are accessing a lot of terrain that the ski area doesn't actually manage or promote as being within. I think it has to be looked at in the context of the overall activity or degree of even control that the federal operator is exerting in the open area. So it's not just a fact of a lift being provided and someone paying, it's the fact of where they're doing their avalanche control and grouping and snow making.
Can I
make a
comment on that? Yeah, I think it depends on what you define as commercial. So a lot of the activities we do on the ski area and the surrounding areas cost a lot of money. And we wouldn't do those activities if we couldn't cover those costs somehow by making the area more attractive for recreational skiing. Having said that, there are a number of people, myself included, who will go up there and ski tour. So generally walking up. The vast majority of such people will use our groomed terrain, which wouldn't be groomed if it wasn't a commercial activity.
But what I'm getting at, the people who are using groomed terrain, they're no problem, because they're in the ski area, so What I'm concerned about is if we take too strict an approach to this differentiation, there are a whole lot of people who ski all over the district outside of ski area subzones. Do we want to get ourselves in a situation where, because they've used the lift to start that, we have to require consents from them? Or do we want to have a definition which is clear that, yes, ski area subzones are commercial areas, and they encompass the area where people are using all facilities provided, but outside of that, no matter how they get there, it's just recreation. With the exception of coming skiing, which is their own separate.
Yeah, so you mean it has a wilderness experience?
Well, it doesn't have to be wilderness, it can be 100 metres away from your boundary.
Yeah, so I suppose it goes to what the expectation of the person would be and what our obligations as a commercial operator would be. So for example, in that area, we will have a large control and make that safe because we know no matter how big a fence we put up to denote a boundary, people will go out there. So we've discharged that obligation. We have used it as part of the ski area since Kirby Basin was there, and we've used guiding out there, so our people may be paying a fee to an instructor. That may be the best terrain for that person's ability to pass in whatever way.
I don't have a problem with calling that commercial recreation, because that comes within that definition.
Yeah.
I understand the issue about avalanche control, certainly. I think that is a matter that we will take into account. Because that obviously, whether it's within or without, inside or outside the boundary, it's think about avalanche control, you do it where it's needed.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
I think you're essentially right though. You don't want to have a situation where as soon as someone sets foot outside the ski area subzone, that they're a non-complying activity.
Mm.
And so I'm not too sure how we get around that, but I don't think we need to have that outcome.
Mm. Okay. The other, in paragraph 15, do I take it from that, where you're talking about the interpretation, presumably, that these banks provided on how the landscape provisions apply in ski area subzones? Are you saying that that is what NZC accepts?
Yes, that's right. That's Mr. Deb's evidence. I did hear the discussion yesterday around that point with Mr. Scott and potentially contradictory views that might have been expressed in an earlier hearing stream. I suppose from the NZC's perspective, particularly with subzone D, that interpretation is favourable in as much as we're saying that level of control, and not level of control, but the relevance of those assessment measures should lie in that subzone at the commercial. A, that they're not ski area activities by definition and appropriate in that landscape, that they should apply to the activity.
That's what I was getting to. So in area B, you're saying that those landscape controls should apply, whether it's in the ONL or the RLC.
Yes.
Right.
Thank you.
No legal questions.
No. Thank you. I'll now ask Mr. Gowshman to put a summary statement to you.
Good morning. My name is Steve Russell Scott.
Could you?
Go ahead.
This is someone? Are you reading out or are you just reading out?
I am just reading out.
Okay.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. I might just skip the introduction from law. It became my primary evidence. That's fine.
Yes.
I'll just move straight through to sort of my summary and rebuttal of Dr. Mary Lee's evidence. Dr. Reed expressed in her rebuttal evidence that the higher level of protection is afforded by the extension to the ski area subzone A, being the Lake Alto Surf area. And the Lake Alto Surf is negated as the activities this extension would provide are permitted activities under amended rule 21.4.19. And in preparing my primary evidence, I was not aware that this proposed amendment, this rule. So I do, however, disagree with Dr. Reed that the higher level of protection which this extension to the ski area subzone would provide to the Lake Alto Surf would create an anomaly in the landscape. I consider that the restrictions on earthworks and buildings in Lake Alto Surf and East Y Saddle, as well as Y Dome, would appropriately protect these highly natural areas from future earthworks and structures and would set a precedent for a higher level of protection in the valued natural areas of Lake Alto Surf, Lake Alto Surf and Y Creek Caverns. I agree with Dr. Reed that the rest of Spurn Basin is totally dominated by natural landforms and that the awareness of ski area infrastructure is inescapable. I consider that the modifications of landform within the ski area subzone is significantly more prevalent in the summer months when the land is not covered in a blanket of snow, giving the landscape a consistent color and texture. And this is the case with all ski areas I visited. I believe there is scope for additional earthworks and or structures to be appropriately located within the proposed extension to the ski area subzone, which would not increase the prevalence of the ski area infrastructure or lead to more than minor adverse cumulative effects on the landscape. Ski area subzone B. Dr. Reed stated that I failed to address the visibility of development from the Remarkables Road itself as a public place. I have driven the Remarkables Road more than 100 times and considered that the subject area where the proposed ski area subzone would be located holds relatively limited visual amenity as it zigzags across the low westerly foot of the mountain. This part of the road is the first or the last experience that the road visitors encounter, offering relatively low experiential qualities as it either preceded by highly memorable and dramatic views of walks through the basin. The subject area itself is clad in exotic woody weeds with generally screened views of the wider landscape. I consider that the proposed ski area subzone area B would result in very low adverse effects on the visual amenity of the remarkable road. With regards to the location of the O&L boundary, while no submissions have been made with respect to its location, I do not consider that the proposed district plan location for this boundary has been thoroughly considered, especially as it crosses the subject sites. The proposed district plan location of the O&L line proposes an arbitrary right-angle bend near the site's southwestern boundary that follows the northern outline of the road before connecting with the topographic transition point between the mountain and the tableland. As I stated in my primary evidence, I consider that the lower portion of the site is linked to the more modified RLC or DAL landscape by land cover and land use panel patterning. The more cultivated vegetation cover of the surrounding land uses, including patches of mature conifers, bookend the site, and I demonstrated this visually in photographs and plants attached to my primary evidence. Upon making this determination of the landscape category boundary, I recommend then that the proposed ski area subzone area B should not extend into the upper portions of the site. I note in her evidence Dr. Reed does not offer her opinion of this category boundary and that there have been no submissions for it to be altered. Dr. Reed considers that should the ski area subzone area B be approved, earthworks would not require mitigation. As I understand this is incorrect, as the previous provisions recommended by Mr. Dent require that earthworks in the ski area subzone area B be subject to restricted discretionary activity status, with discretion held over scale, location, visual quality and natural landforms, visibility from the state highway, and landscape planting and rehabilitation. Regardless, it is important to note that the lower portions of the site where the ski area subzone area B will be located are not highly visible from the wider landscape. This part of the western slopes of the Remarkables is insignificant in scale when compared to the much more dominant bowl of the Remarkables western bay. Contrary to Dr. Reed's opinion, I have considered the effects of buildings and ancillary activities as part of my primary evidence. I understand that the serious subzone area D is, I understand that if the ski area subzone B is approved, the construction of the buildings would be restricted discretionary activity. Dr. Reed assesses that the area B would create a note of ski related activities, and I consider that this area is part of the rural landscape category. It has visual associations with the large scale commercial activities within a remarkable park, as well as recent developments which will occur in the handy down area. It is my assessment that appropriately controlled buildings and retail activities could occur within the proposed area B without having adverse visual effects on the wider landscape. When experienced in the more immediate landscape, the area subzone B would be helpful in the context of existing residual developments, which have led to a more modified character of the Cone River Valley. I consider that a node of ski area infrastructure, which may be enabled by the area B, would continue the more modified character of the surrounding landscape and would, if appropriately controlled, retain the existing visual amenity and landscape character. Overall, I consider that the ski area subzone A, on the upper part of the mountain, would appropriately protect the more sensitive Lake Officer, Y Dome, and East Y Saddle, while enabling appropriate ski area activities in areas of landscape that could absorb development without reducing the amenity or character of the landscape. I also consider that Area B, in the low rural landscape category portion of the site, where appropriately controlled activities would not adversely affect the visual amenity or character of the foot of the remarkables. This area D would be experienced within the context of existing and residual development and would not exacerbate the existing more modified character of the Cumberland Valley.
Okay,
reading a summary that we would have available. I'm not quite sure what he read, but it doesn't seem to be his primary evidence.
No.
And we don't have a copy of it either.
Of the summary?
Of what he did, I did actually get him to bring some copies.
I
do have copies.
I'm definitely
very contextual, and of course we got the opportunity to get questions from Dr. Reed yesterday. In terms of Area A, above Lake Alpha and above Kirby Basin, from a landscape perspective, talking about sort of how visual it is further away, how much of your landscape is all experiential, i.e. what people see? I know definitions there are some biophysical, but what, how much of it is experiential, i.e. what's seen?
I think in this context, it's mostly experiential. Being in what is a natural alpine environment and the effects of there being some development in that area, the visual effects of development, especially from Lake Alta Basin, to me are significant, in that if your back is to the ski area and you're looking up at the Delta Cone Lake Alta area, you have no visual contact with with the ski area infrastructure. It's not until you sort of wrap around it that then you have that experience or quality of being part of that, the ski area infrastructure.
So the question I then have is, presumably the majority of people who will see potentially a modified landscape, and they are slightly different because Dean's proposing a prohibitive because that is what building and other things, so it's around the avalanche control and ski grooming. So presumably people who are seeing it are people who are going up to ski or to tram. So from a landscape perspective, how do you build in sort of expectation? Those people probably expect to see something there, as opposed to Joe just in public who are down the ground dropping up here.
Well, the experience of getting ready would be moving through the more modified earthworks. I mean, I've walked up there a lot. You're walking on the flatter, easier graded ski slopes that access the lake also. So you've already had that experience of being in the more modified ski area. So I'm not sure if I'm fully understanding.
Well, what I'm trying to get to, I mean, one of the issues we put to Dr. Reed yesterday was around, you know, outstanding natural landscapes, which this is, and you don't step away from that. Of course, if a go comes within the ski zone, it's taken outside of that, as I understand it. So the question I really have got is, what is classed as inappropriate subgroup use and development? In the sense of, if this is an outstanding area, within effectively somewhere people go on the ski or tram. So what's inappropriate? Is it the effect of that activity, or these sort of activities appropriate and therefore they need to be controlled for sure that they're not?
I think the spill of the existing effect would be inappropriate. I've been around long enough to be in Lost Lake Halls Basin where you could look behind you and not see anything, but now you can see just the top of the Curtain Basin cliff. And that has had a very, very minor adverse effect on the naturalness of that area. But I think the spill of it, and that's what we've really tried to do by proposing this rule 21.5.3x on the restriction of earthworks and buildings in that lake altar area to give it that higher level of protection so that no future significant effects would spill into that area. And that's been my primary concern. And then after reading Dr. Reed's evidence and her concerns about potential structures being located on the saddle between Y and Turkey Basin, that would then spill that infrastructure into the Y area attachment. So to me, I think that would be, could potentially be an adverse effect because those are more highly natural areas. So when you're in the Strassisburg catchment, which is contained by topography, you're kind of, especially in the times the ski area is operating, the sounds, the visual effects of the existing ski infrastructure is fairly omnipresent. But when you get up into this Lake Alder Basin, it seems to be distant. Even though you can still see it, the feeling is that it's a separate area.
Just explain to me a bit more, just when you talk about sort of up on the ridge, it could be an adverse effect. What are we talking about? Minor? Less than minor, more than minor significant? Or is that depends on what gets built?
It depends on what would be built there. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in the White Creek catchment, and as you're coming back into the ski area, there's no sound, there's no visual built structures. So I think, you know, a small sign there probably wouldn't have an adverse effect. I think a building or perhaps a ski lift located on that ridge line, the noise that it would generate, that would probably have a significant adverse effect on the naturalness of the White Creek catchment.
Thank you. I've got other questions on B, but I don't think we've got keep going on B. So you come down to C area B, and again, there's clearly a difference of opinion between you and Dr. Reed. When I asked Dr. Reed whether she agreed with your amended line, accepting that it's not intended to move the other line, she disagreed, and she said that it still was outstanding. So tell me, what is the major difference of opinion between? Why do you say it's, in your what redefined line above that line? Or is it, what's the difference? How do you approach that to be different?
How do I approach it?
To be different from who? So if you do give us a set of criteria that these areas are identified as outstanding, or we see whatever factors the council views, you apply them or something different to come up with a different answer.
That's why I looked at the Cullenberg Valley study, and I read the environmental court decision on how that was located, and I realized that most of that was concerned with the periphery landscapes, not the subject area that I was looking at. And I think the line, it actually comes across and then it hits the site and takes the meteorite angles to the south and then follows the northern edge of the road. But when you look at the photographs that I provided in my evidence with your own site, it doesn't seem to be a justifiable line. And to me, that the patch of the conifers that exist on either side of the site, that those actually create a more legible distinction in the landscape character. To the north of the site, on those more open flat pastures, just as the road bends, there's a distinct change in landscape. Where the Kingston Road passes to the west of the site, it's more of a rolling table lands topography, and it's with the vegetation cover, it's not as distinct where that change in character takes place. So my interpretation was that it would be more linked by those passes of conifers that book in that site and to make that immediate right angle turn and then follow the outside line, because either side of that road, you're looking at where the O&O line is located, is exactly the same in terms of part of the vegetation cover.
Now, some other impressions, Mr. Keith, that sort of related to that when we come to that evidence. There are a number of concerns which are held on that side, we know that outlined in Mr. Keith's evidence. So that and we've heard about the existing environment, and your evidence is that visitor accommodation is a strictly discretionary activity, is appropriate to manage the landscape effect. Do you hold that view if there have been no consents? Are you relying on sort of there is always some modification enabled through those consents, some of you say that? Because otherwise it's just effectively a rural site with some outstanding natural landscape on it.
I'm relying on not necessarily those specific consents, but the development that occurred on the adjacent sites as well. And in terms of council's discussion on what would be appropriate, we would have different considerations on what could be appropriate development there. But it's my experience in the district that low, dark, recessive colors with appropriate planting, positive effects can be an appropriate way.
So just help me out. So in terms of the development skill on adjacent sites, what are you talking about?
There are structures visible immediately to the south, and there's also a quarry to the south of the site. Generally, those aren't highly visible or even perceivable. It's not until you look closely that you can see them, or if you're on top of the mountain looking down, you can see the pattern of development a lot more clearly. But most users will generally experience the site from the Waukesha Basin and the Cullenberg Valley. So I was assessing that pattern of existing development and old things, structures and quarry, that sort of works through the table land before it drops down into that more distinct transition
in landscape. Do you accept, put aside your decline boundary for now, again, would your view be the same of allowing as a description for the physical accommodation of the building in an outstanding therefore landscape on that site? Well, again, your influence is usually by your view that it's not outstanding, it's short portion.
Well, it does depend on the type of development proposed. But I think that appropriate development, regardless of the landscape category, could be absorbed on the site.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Diana.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Sean Beck. I'm a resource management planning consultant and director of the Southern Planning Group. I'm here today to be an expert planning evidence on behalf of NZ Ski Limited. I wish to make comments in respect of the council's rebuttal evidence dated 20th April 2017. However, I'll first respond to Ms. Bank's summary of evidence, which raised an error with the council's GIS system and its planning maps. The submitted plans of the proposed rezoning on the rest of the firm have been prepared by surveyors of Clark City and Cromwell and Associates based on information obtained from council's GIS system in 2015. I've not had the opportunity to confer with the surveyor who prepared these plans regarding the new information from Ms. Bank, as she has subsequently left the firm. However, if the information provided by Ms. Banks is accurate, it means that the submission seeking rezoning in this area of land is now largely irrelevant, with the exception of the area above, Lake Acid, which has been sought to ensure the submitted activity status of ski area activities. As to your earlier comments or suggestions, sir, I'm happy to focus with Ms. Banks and provide further information on this matter in due course.
Yes, that would be helpful.
Notwithstanding this new information, which needs to be checked, I acknowledge Ms. Banks' change in position with respect to now supporting the proposed ski area subzone expansion east of the White Dome Spur, should this area be within jurisdiction. However, Ms. Banks and I remain interested in disagreement about the expansion of the ski area subzone to the west and above Lake Albert to accommodate ski area activities. Specifically, Ms. Banks retains the view that ski area activity can be undertaken outside of the ski area subzone without resource consent obligations, subject to a recommended change to proposed District Plan Rule 21.419 to address this matter. I still hold the opinion that this approach is contrary to the zone purpose, which is to enable the development of ski area activities within the identified subzones. I also hold the opinion that the extension of the ski area subzone into this area with the building line restriction and accompanying prohibited activity rule for all earthworks, buildings and infrastructure is a stronger protective mechanism than retaining the rural zoning as proposed by Ms. Banks. In regards to the proposed ski area subzone B, the proposed zoning and applicable provisions I have recommended will not enable ski area activities to occur within this area of land, and neither will ski area activities be physically possible given the low altitude of the proposed subzone. Zoning and provisions are directed only at providing for buildings and activities that directly support the continued operation of the remarkable ski area. For clarity, the submitter is not seeking the relocation of the OML line identified in the proposed district plan. Mr. Skelton's interpretation of where this might lie has been used to inform his views about potential rezoning's visual effects on a wider landscape pattern and legibility, but no submission has been made to alter its location. As such, I agree with Ms. Banks in that the ONL and RLC categories will apply to the proposed area of rezoning because it comprises a subzone of the rural zone, and in addition, because the zoning will not accommodate ski area activities as defined, the landscape assessment matters in Chapter 21 of the proposed district plan will also continue to apply in association with the strategic chapters of the proposed district plan and the objectives, policies and rules that I've recommended, which collectively will enable a robust assessment of future development within the proposed subzone. Ms. Banks has also criticised the creation of a site-specific zoning and suggests that it undermines the key goal of the district plan review to reduce the complexity and length of the proposed district plan. With respect, the additional length to the proposed district plan resulting from the proposed provisions is not a relevant environmental consideration, and regardless, I consider the proposed amendments to have a negligible effect in this regard and will be easily understood. Ms. Banks has also criticised the proposed rezoning with respect to access and infrastructure servicing. In regards to transportation, the proposed provisions require that for any commercial activities or residential staff accommodation, visitor accommodation, parking and access, congestion and safety are matters of discretion. Furthermore, the site was designated as a limited access road on a certificate of title, and any change in the use of the existing vehicle crossing and any new crossings as such were required would necessitate NZCA approval, which Council could request due to the proposed restricted discretionary activity status. I note that the NZCA have not submitted an opposition to this rezoning request. I do accept Mr. Glasson's evidence that the council has no intention to extend potable and wastewater recirculating services in the vicinity of the subject site, and that Jack's Point and Hanley Down services are already fully allocated. However, Mr. Glasson also states that he is not opposed to on-site systems. Given the size of the subject site, I expect appropriately designed wastewater disposal systems to be a viable disposal method. I also note that while a ball permit, which requires a controlled activity consent from the NRC, would be required, an on-site ball could be capable of extraction of 25,000 litres a day of groundwater as a permitted activity. Further, while approval would be required from NZCA, QRBC and DOC to submit the source up to 1 million litres a day of surface water from the Cowrail River as a permitted activity and pump this to the site just over 1 kilometre away. Given the above, I consider that the site could be appropriately serviced by means other than council recirculated services and propose provisions before council discretion under such matters. At paragraph 4.8 of her rebuttal, Ms. Banks has also sought verification as to whether my recommended table 11 is an activity table or a standards table, largely because of the inclusion to date of a standard for a maximum building footprint. For clarity, I consider table 11 to be an activity table and propose standard 21.5.55 regarding the maximum building size could potentially be deleted given the restricted discretion for buildings generally in the activity standard 21.5.54, which covers external appearance and visual prominence. I'm happy to answer any questions from the panel within my area of expertise.
Thank you. A few questions, but going to area A first, and the area above the lake, you recommended prohibited activity status for those things, which is clearly the extreme end. Can you explain a little bit more, given Ms. Banks' view that her view was quite clear that those things like avalanche control were not meant to be excluded, and there might be technical issues there, but she's recommended making it permitted, you just raised that. Given that, what would be, in fact, we could tell me, what would be the advantage of making this area a ski, a sub-zone? Particularly given that your clients are seen and you're committed no building, no increase.
Yes, so firstly, I think it accords with the purpose of the ski area sub-zone, that the ski area sub-zone is to enable the continued development of ski area activities as defined within the identified sub-zones. It seems somewhat ad hoc to me to have ski area activities immediately on the periphery of an existing zone and not include that within the ski area sub-zone. But also, as Mr. Anderson referred to earlier today, there is the potential, and I understand they already do, undertake some commercial guide and potentially commercial ski lessons and plans within the area as well. And therefore, it would be appropriate that those activities, which I think to be ski area activities, are contained within the zone.
So from a Section 32 point of view, you see this as a more efficient way of dealing with the whole package, really, in terms of that ski sub-zone area, including this part, and I think, and I've got the name, sorry, it's already used effectively as part of that ski activity zone anyway.
Yes, that's correct.
Just that the last question I've got on that part of it is, why did you go to the prohibited activity and not simply say we will rely on, make it a ski zone, but sort of an exemption and just say rely on the rural zone provisions which apply everywhere else?
Two reasons. The landscape architecture evidence overwhelmingly between Mr. Skelton and Dr. Reid suggests that any physical modification and built form in that area is appropriate. So there's no support for such activities. I've also been involved in applications with the NZSC for the water extraction from Lake Alta, and that's involved concessions, notified concessions through the Department of Conservation. And I know through their conservation management strategy and their processes that the Lake Alta cert is incredibly important in terms of its natural abilities as well, and therefore physical modification in that area.
Thank you. Coming to area B, and it's one of the things where I'll just put the question, I think you've even said in your summary statement that this is a ski area subzone to enable skiing activities, and you've effectively acknowledged that this zone would not be for that.
Yes, that's right. So what the provisions that we had sought, or I recommended in the ski area subzone B, would not fall within the definition of ski area activities.
So what you're really seeking is a, what it's called there, is a different zone to enable the activities which uses facilitating the ski activities that you do right.
Yes, that's correct, and I believe Mr. Donald touched on it briefly this morning, but the remarkable ski area is somewhat different to Colony Peaks or Cadrona, where whilst they're still in an alpine environment, they have reasonably large expanses of mountain place within which to work in. The remarkable is quite different when you come up to the base area facilities. You've got several car parks, base building, and then immediately behind that, the learner ski area. And it's really the pinch point of the mountain surf coming down. And I've been involved in a number of applications here as well with DOC and the Australian Regional Council and QLSC, where we've actually had to relocate the Erasmus Journey Stream to the immediate east of the pin point, and the Shadow Basin Stream as well has been moved as far westward as possible, and it's recently extended last year. NUC has got a new medical centre building in that area. The only physical area that they had remaining was to actually construct that building over the Erasmus Journey Stream very constrained environment for them to be able to develop any further and provide those facilities to help operate safely.
So again, in section 32 terms, the tip 3 in advising out that, I don't know if you were involved in formulating this submission, but I'm wondering why a special zone, say, was identified and not called a sub-zone. And the second question I've got after that is, in section 32 efficiency terms, given that your client holds consents for movers and port upon the signs and all that, the one that hasn't got is visitor accommodation, which if I'm reading the plan like that would be a discretionary activity. Why would not just rely on the resource consent process? Again, in section 32 terms, achieve the right outcome, i.e. don't get a special design for this in a rural zone, which you approve resources. So the first one is, what's your consideration given to a whole different zone? You might have bought a whole set of different sort of things.
In effect, the idea of having a ski area sub-zone B is, I guess, a special zone or a bespoke zoning. But I wanted to really demonstrate that what we're seeking here is a set of unique provisions directly associated with the operation of the remarkable area, not just another random central zone within the district.
The second part of that is, and part of the question I was talking to something about in terms of their whole activity space, why in section 32 terms not just rely on the resource consent process, a number of consents have already held, and it's from my reading, it looks like the one that your clients are seeking is a visitor accommodation, largely for workers' accommodation, I understand, and others, which would require discretionary consent, I think. You're recommending restricted discretionary with the restrictions around visual amenity and those things, which would be clearly one of the methods which are relevant to an outstanding network area or higher rail. Why don't we just rely on the resource consent process?
So I have addressed that in my evidence, but I think the key issue with the proposed district plan as it was notified, looking at either ORL or RLC categories and going through the strategic provisions in the Chapter 3, Chapter 6, and then down to the assessment matters in Chapter 21, they are all heavily geared, in my view, towards protection and essentially not having development within the rural landscape at all, and the assessment matters in chapter 21 talk about development and subdivision and use in those areas pretty much being inappropriate in almost all locations. So what I've tried to achieve with this zoning is to enable those activities that aren't directly relevant and necessary to be maintaining the operation of the remarkable ski area, but also whilst enabling those activities, maintaining a very robust ability for assessment, given that I accept there are landscape values to protect them.
Right. Presumably you're upset though in an area of outstanding equities that you would expect a fairly high planning ratio.
Yes, I would say that.
So you were able to support this proposed zoning, presumably relying on Mr. Skelton's landscape evidence, including that bit which is an ONL, but Mr. Skelton says doesn't really meet that. So you're relying on that evidence.
Yes, so in my view, I think Mr. Skelton's evidence has been more considered and comprehensive and has much more acknowledgement of the proposed provisions that, that would go with that. So, so I have relied on his evidence, he said.
So, like, point. So again, your, and it might be a question of Mr. Donald, but I'll put it to you in it. Why was no request made to move the ONL lines? Was that simply you didn't think of that at the time and it's only when you got the evidence? Wouldn't it have been better to have formally requested that that line be moved?
I think even if we had sought and successfully moved that line up, as I was mentioning before, the assessment matters in Chapter 21 in particular, even for the rural landscape category, are still geared towards heavy protection and not enabling development within the rural landscape category. Therefore, we still need to have this other special zone or sub-zone applied over the top.
Right. Do you accept it's probably more straightforward to get a consent outside of the ONL, i.e. the Section 6 matters don't apply to it because they're not outstanding?
Yes, to some degree, that would be true, sir.
So just a couple of details. I was looking at the change that you were suggesting, and this is, I think it was a page. Anyway, in terms of your objectives, 21.27, where you're suggesting inserting a particular objective to enable the establishment and operation of activities in built form that are similar to which and facilitate the successful operation of the market sphere. It's a detailed question. I just wonder who determines what a successful operation is. I mean, and do the council, the panel recommendations of the council, that kind of overstates it a bit. Who's determining successful? I assume that's your wording, that's the read. Have you got that in front
of you? Yes, sorry, I'm just rereading it, sir. So I see what you're saying, that perhaps it does overstate it, and in terms of who would determine what is a successful operation, I guess that would become a judgment call, and perhaps that objective could be more appropriately worded by simply removing that from the operation of the remarkable ski area.
And the final piece of it, and it is quite a detailed question, I see, but I just can't understand the package. The other thing in that same objective, where you talk about landscape, natural landscape can be mitigated, and it's a theme that's come this year, but certainly some other areas we're going to get where about mitigating the landscape effects. And I'm just wondering whether mitigation and outstanding natural landscape still need to get into policy that might be useful. This is good enough. That mitigate is the right word. Are we going to reduce them or avoid them?
With the zoning that we've proposed, I don't think we would entirely avoid potential effects on the landscape, but my understanding from what Mr. Skelton has presented is that you could accommodate built form and activities such as what we've proposed in the provisions here that fit within the existing landscape pattern and without detracting from the wider outstanding natural landscape. Therefore, I think mitigation is the appropriate word in this instance.
Right, I'll take that. And you might have a question about visitor accommodation, I think you might have some. Oh, thank you very much.
I'm just looking at the map of the ski area, remarkable ski area, and just trying to determine exactly what would be gained by including area A in the ski zone when my kind of experiences from up at the Remarkables is that there's quite a few other skiable areas which aren't being thought to be included into the area, such as the onshore avalanche control and touring and guided touring, so commercial activity can happen on as well, such as say the chutes on the other side of Lake Alta. So they're not included in the current ski area subzone.
And that isn't for any specific purpose. Ironically, whilst I've been engaged by the NZSD, I'm not actually a skier or boarder myself. So, personally, I wasn't aware of the use of the chutes. I was made aware of that after we had lodged the submission. And my understanding is that we wouldn't have the scope to include that area. However, in hindsight, if I hadn't known about that previously, I believe it is appropriate that those ski area activities and the use of that natural terrain should fall within the ski area subzone boundary.
Can I perhaps address that?
Yep.
Those of my choose your own hearing means.
Yep.
From my perspective, it's more you kind of think about where our guests generally go, and while it's true that some guests do go up Shadow Basin, hike up and beyond, it's very clear that that is beyond the ski area boundary. Whereas the natural, you don't even need to hike to get to this area that we're submitting should be ski area subzone above Lake Alta. It's very easily traversable. So a high number of our guests do go into that area. So from my perspective, I thought the area above Lake Alta, it's only accessed by extremely expert skiers and riders. It doesn't need to be zoned as a serious subzone. But we quite simply don't undertake avalanche control up there at any time.
There you go.
No. If there's avalanche danger, it is closed. So it's known as a high risk zone. It's clearly outside the ski area boundary.
So even though it's outside of your jurisdiction, so to speak, as far as the subzone, it's still controlled by, your access is still controlled by NZSK by way of closing that back country, because in a way you're still responsible for people in that area, is that what you're saying?
From a health and safety perspective, it would be a grey area, it's fair to say. We would say that the practical steps we take to manage the risk in that area is through signage and bad blue line fencing, but people will still go there. From our perspective, it's a very low number, whereas, as I said, it's a little bit like the back bowls of Coronet Peak. No matter how big a fence we put up there, people would stand there for some time, and it's very easily accessible by traversing, so they will just continue to go. So from a pragmatic perspective, we would go in there and make sure it's safe.
So essentially, the reason for the extension of the subzone on that this side of Lake Alta with area A is because of the curvy lift going
correct
right up next to it.
Yep.
And so there would be no future scenario where potentially even a rope tow would go up to, from the top of Shadow up to the top there to open up that space. Even if, and then the back bowls as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. There is potential in the future that we might apply to realign the Shadow Basin lift. There is a nice area to, if you're looking up the Shadow Basin to the left, that faces out, which would access those chutes. That is a relatively low probability though at this stage.
Okay. All right. No, thank you very much. No further questions.
Thank you.
maybe we'll just carry on the check thing at the moment. I mean, this issue that we have about skiing inside and outside of the ski area subzones, do you agree that arises because of the change from the ODP where everything not mentioned was permitted to the proposed land where everything not mentioned is non-compliant? Is that the reality?
Yes, sir.
And so we need to ensure that we are not cutting off the ability for activities which innocuous is the word that comes to mind, aren't unnecessarily controlled. Is that part of your concern?
Service that was acknowledged is already a consent in place. The building for that is relatively small, and the existing car park also is relatively small given the popularity of the Remarkables. Perhaps the biggest one I will see at the moment is the visitor accommodation. And I refer to it as visitor accommodation, sir, but I expect it more to be a workers' accommodation. Accommodation because the definition refers to short-term stays of potentially less than 3 months, which could be the case with any seasonal workforce.
Just on that point, I think we had submissions in the rural stream, in particular from, I can't remember if it was Soho or Cadrona, about a new terminology to provide for on-mountain worker accommodation. Were you familiar with that?
I was involved in
that. There was some discussion about the length of time being up to 6 months. But it's that sort of thing that you're talking about.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, the provisions that I've proposed whilst they refer to visitor accommodation, they're purely to encapsulate short-term worker stays, not visitor accommodation in the traditional sense.
And you don't see it being used for the normal visitor accommodation sense, in other words, skiers booking a couple of rooms there and then just shuffling up and down?
No, I think referring to that earlier here in Stream, sir, there was some discussion about providing for visitor accommodation within the actual ski areas themselves.
Yes.
But I was in support of that, and I think as a tourist who would want to come and potentially stay on the ski field, it would be more desirable to actually stay right up on the field as opposed to in this zone that we're promoting at the moment.
Now, given those four activities that you've listed, is it necessary to have a zone, or is it more that with appropriate
objectives and policies, and you've made some suggestions there, that some specification for those activities on that site would achieve the same outcome.
I think providing the specific zone recognises the importance of those activities in the marginal ski areas in general, and the risk of having simply some objectives and policies set amongst the overall strategic objectives and policies in chapter 3 and 6, and as responding to Commissioner Hill looking at the assessment matters that would apply from chapter 21, they're all still very geared towards the absolute protection of the landscape. I think the zoning and recognition of the importance of the ongoing operation of the ski field that we're promoting in these provisions would be more appropriate.
My understanding of Ms. McDonald's answer to my question was that NZ Ski were happy for the landscape provisions to apply to the activities proposed. And I took from that that would include the assessment criteria. Is that not what you mean?
No, that is correct, sir, that the assessment criteria would apply, but the activity status that I've recommended is restricted discretion, and I think it seems to signal that the appropriately developed, designed and selected activity on the site could be appropriate on a modified basis, whereas relying on the current proposed plan provisions is much further to the other end of the spectrum, would be much more difficult to have the same outcome through a reasonable consent process.
If you have an activity that is a restricted discretionary activity, and one of the matters of consideration is landscape, and you still have to consider those assessment criteria.
Yes, you do.
Yeah. If you have a restricted discretionary activity in the rural zone, supported by specific objectives and policies in the rural zone, what is the difference between that and having a special bespoke zone?
Sorry, sir, can you repeat that question?
Well, I started off by asking you whether you considered the four activities could be provided for on that site without the zone, and you replied that special zone would make it more explicit that they were enabled. Then you agreed with me that all the landscape assessment criteria would apply as a restricted discretionary activity if landscape was a matter of consideration. But what I'm asking is, if what is the distinction in reality, in practical terms, between having a special zone, a spoke zoning on the land, or just providing for the activities that are restricted to discretionary activity on this land?
I think if you had adequately robust objective policy direction, then yes, you would achieve the same outcome potentially without having to enable the bespoke zoning.
Returning to the submission that was lodged, this is something I'm not sure about in it. And it's in the attachment that sets out the zone provisions.
to be proposed. It's on page 21 and 25. Buildings or structures within the subzone B above 1300 metres, is that what does that relate to?
Sir, that was an error that provision remained that some previous discussions that I had with NZC about the potential of extending the area subzone along the access road.
Right. Yes. I mean, we're a long way to 1300 metres. We're now talking about, aren't we?
Yes.
But, in terms of the worker accommodation, probably best that we refer to it as that. Is there a you say in your suggested the deficit policies that has your evidence that it's necessary or remarkable. Is this an issue that is only an issue for the remarkable, or is an issue more widespread than that?
I probably couldn't give you any advice on this. My understanding is that yes, it's just one amongst the other operators as well, so I can't expect anything to do with it.
And I suppose the other question is there any, in your mind, any idea of the scale that we're talking about on this? Or do you think that is something that should be left for the actual application itself?
That is something that I have considered, sir. I understand Sid raised questions about density and overall scale. I think that is something best left to Brussels concerning the application process and acknowledge that, certainly in rural assessment criteria, there are assessment matters that look at site density and cumulative effects as well. And I do appreciate on that site at some point there would become a threshold of the site's ability to absorb further development.
It's a question coming through from what Pursue was talking about. If you've got your evidence, the provisions that you recommend, this is on 21-20, and go to 21-5, the issue about visitor accommodation. I'm just reflecting on what Mr. Stilton was saying. I know there is discretion is restricted to those methods, scale, location, parking, provision. And some of the other provisions, it does talk about landscape and visual. Is it quite deliberate that you've taken out the landscape effect because this is would be within a ski zone and therefore the landscape provisions are no longer relevant? Or is it an oversight?
No, it's not an oversight, but yes, because this provision, which is in Table 7, relates directly to the ski area subzones and the existing modified environments that are already in that subzone.
So, Mr. Skilton's answer to one of my questions was, if they say a visitor accommodation was proposed, it would clearly fit in with the environment and talk about design and those developments. If you agree with that, how would that be taken into account under those methods of execution?
Mr. Skelton's response, I think, might have been related to the provision of visitor accommodation, workers' accommodation within the ski area subzone B, not the actual ski area.
So this doesn't apply to B?
recognise those services for visitor accommodation or sort of tourist visitor accommodation within the remarkable ski area or other ski areas outside.
So my reading is saying, well, most of these types of standards for activities within the ski area subzone, this is called the ski area subzone, but then...
Yes, but the ski area subzone fees need to be sort of bespoke and sent out from table 7.
Okay.
Table 7, and that rule in particular applies to all the ski area subzones for the district.
Right, okay. Coming, and just a couple, one technical question related to, if you go to 21/27,
yes sir,
can you just check for me, rule 21/556, it states an RDA, these are controller is reserved, and the observer should be destroyed. I just check in.
Yes, that's correct, sir.
The activity is RD.
Yes.
And the same for 21/560 earthworks and RD. So just need to, if we go with this, then we need to change the language.
That's correct.
Okay, discretion, right.
And just while we're talking about amendments to those rules there as well, there's one I noticed this morning in regards to 21/557. One of the bullet points there in regards to visitor accommodation or worker accommodation, we call it that. The second to the last one talks about hourly operation. I don't think that bullet point is particularly relevant. Hourly operation is often relevant for other visitor accommodation activities where you might have ancillary restaurants and facilities like that. I don't think it would be appropriate for workers accommodation.
So can I ask you the same question in relation to that? That's the one about is the equivalent rule that I was pointing out before. So again, those location, nature, scale of activities, parking, location, further noise and accommodation. So again, the visual appearance or the landscape thing in your view is not relevant because we can identify it as being an appropriate development within that zone. That's how you deal with that issue.
Yes.
And again, you know, even though part of it would still be within an outstanding level, and that if the panel accepts the zone, it accepts that development is appropriate in there and the landscape provisions don't apply as they would in a rural zone.
So the landscape provisions and assessment criteria would still apply, sir.
So how would that come into account with those the only matters that you can consider?
I think you're correct, you probably could or should put landscape character and amenity in there. But I guess it was intended to be tied in with that first bullet point regarding the location, nature and
right.
How activities on the site, but it should be more specific as a restrictive discretionary status.
Thank you. I understand that.
Yes, but I'm just clarifying because 21/554 on the previous page is the building, and that included visual prominence, landscape character. I just wondered whether your intention with 57 was that was the activity within the building, on the building itself, or...
Yes, that's correct, sir. They do complement each other, those
right.
Buildings, and you wouldn't have the workers' accommodation without the buildings.
Yeah. Thank you. Nothing else about this one. Right. Thank you, Mr. P.
Yes, thanks for that for the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.